Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 169, which is the second of our two-part episode on grasslands with Professor Carolyn Stromberg of the University of Washington. As always, with our two-parters, you first need to go and listen to episode 168, because otherwise, this episode isn't going to make an awful lot of sense, and you'll be missing out on loads of context about what grasses and grasslands are. In this second part, we're finally going to be looking at the evolution of grasslands and the impact that they have had around the planet and what the significance of their study is today. So, having forgotten who originally requested this episode, Sam got in touch to claim the glory, and so all thanks goes to them for such a great suggestion. And if you have a subject that you want to hear an interview on, then please do get in touch however you can. For those of you who are paying very close attention, you might notice that this episode is being released slightly earlier, and that's because we've managed to get another interview lined up about a new dinosaur that's coming out on the 15th, when this episode was originally supposed to be released. It's always great to get the opportunity to have such in-depth discussions about the latest science with all of those extra insights available on the very same day that a paper comes out. Unfortunately, following everyone's enjoyment of the puns that I've been managing to crowbar into the last couple of introductions, releasing this episode early means that I haven't had the time to work on any jokes. So, if the lack of any grass puns is leaving you feeling forlorn, then please don't have a poo EDA, because the early release of this episode will hopefully still give you a rice, we talk corny jokes, which is probably a fair way to do it. So, did C4 grasses undergo an explosive radiation? Can harsh arid environments be tolerated by C3POoids? Answers to this and more are coming, and we all know that consuming grass podcasts will make you hip, so don't miss out. Pictures to accompany this episode are available on our website and are very helpful when trying to understand the different timelines of grass evolution, so please take a look at those. And any actions that you take on social media really helps the show grow, and that includes the comments section. So please feel very free to leave me your best grass puns, or alternatively plead that we never do them ever again. It all helps. So you will be seeing me again in just a couple of days for episode 170, but until then, I hope you enjoy this episode. So we've now defined what a grass is and looked at the evolution of grasses. We've defined what grasslands are. Now, can we look at the evolution of grasslands? So with that, I mean, have grasslands been present ever since grasses evolved? Like, I know you said the first ones were kind of like within the shadows of the trees, but how long did it take them to start forming grasslands? Was it pretty instantaneous, I'd guess?
I think the truth is that we don't know for sure, but the evidence that we have right now, and really evidence that we've had for a long time, because people used to look at the animal fossil record to determine when grasslands evolved, the idea has been that grasslands have not spread until 25 million years ago or so, and thereafter, and that for, you know, some 75 million years of their history before that, they were not forming grasslands. Because the fossil record is so sparse, we cannot be absolutely certain of that. And there could have been, you know, like little meadows next to rivers or something like that. We don't know that. So that's something we don't know. But we think that these wide expanses of grasslands didn't evolve until after 25 million years ago or so. And wait, what was the other part of the question? Sorry.
I can't remember myself either.
Okay. Right. So the I can say that you mentioned sort of the early... I talked about how the early grasses likely were forest grasses or forest margin. there are the two main groups that have grasses that dominate in open grasslands are the cool temperate so-called poid grasses and the tropical so-called pack-mat grasses. The pack-mats contain all the C4 grasses and the poids are all C3. And so those two groups evolved pretty early on, we think, certainly by, say, 55 million years ago or so. So that's still very far, you know, or it could have been even further back, 65, 66 or something. But either way, that's still, you know, tens of millions of years before we see grasslands in the fossil record. So we don't know if the climate just wasn't conducive to allowing grasses to excel at the expense of trees, or not at the expense of trees, but where trees couldn't grow and grasses could, or if those early members of those groups were also more forest adapted or something in between. We don't know that. So that's another thing we're trying to figure out is, when did those adaptations evolve that allowed grasses to thrive in these arid open habitats? And when were the climatic conditions such that we see them? Because as we talked about, some climates or some parts of the landscape are not preserved as often in the fossil record. So I said that phytoliths can be preserved in dry soils, whereas pollen cannot. It's also true that certain, like deserts and vast expanses of drier lands, they're not as commonly preserved in the fossil record, just because most of what we see in the fossil record are lakes and sort of lowland, wetter environments. So I'm kind of mixing up two different biases here, but basically most of the fossil record that we have is from wetter habitats. So we might be missing drier habitats that were around during this long gap, and we just don't have a record of them, at least not at the moment.
So if there is a delay between the appearance of these two different groups, the poids and the pack-mad, was it?
Yeah, pack-mad. Yeah. It's an acronym.
I remembered. Right. Basically, C3 and C4 open grasses, right? Yeah. If we see those groups before we see grasslands, then I want to run two different scenarios. Mm-hmm. Either these grasses share a common ancestor that like was able to form a grasslands. We just don't have the evidence for it for a few million years. And like, maybe if we looked hard enough or found different ways of determining whether a grassland was present or not, we would find that the evolution of grasslands was something that all of these grasses shared. Or these two different groups diversified first, and then independently, each one of them started to be a grassland. And so that's the difference between like homology and convergence in their ecology. Did they start off all doing the same thing and we just don't have the evidence for it? Or did they each independently come up with how to live as a grassland?
Most likely the latter. And we know that because we can look at the family tree of grasses, the phylogeny, and we can see that for the poids, for example, poets and pack-mats don't share a most recent common ancestor. Poets are more closely related to bamboos than they are to pack-mats. So they don't share a common ancestor. It's unlikely they share a common ancestor that was adapted to open habitats. Also, within the poids, the most early diverging poids are actually forest grasses. And then if you look within the pack mats, there's a lot of grasses there that are C3 and adapted to more shady or wet environments. And then you see multiple independent sort of lineages that are open, adapted to open habitats, and those are primarily the C4 grasses. So just looking at the distribution of those ecologies across the grass family tree, we feel pretty darn certain that these are independent origins of that ecology, which is very cool because it means that there was some, it means there's some environmental driver, but I will also want to point out that within the pack mat clade, there are multiple origins of C4 grasses, and they did not happen at the same time. So it started pretty early on, maybe in the Paleocene, so just after the extinction of dinosaurs. And then there's been origins of C4 probably, you know, up until just a few million years ago.
Wow. And so,
yeah.
I didn't even think of that as a possibility as well. That kind of photosynthesis is also independently evolved multiple times.
Mm-hmm. And not just...
Oh, it's complicated.
It's very complicated. And not just in grasses, but like sedges, for example, and dryad-adapted shrubs and things like that. So also have C4 photosynthesis independently. But in terms of biomass, the C4 grasses are king.
So what are the challenges that grasses need to overcome to form a grassland? So why aren't our earliest grasses, you know, they're growing in the shadows of trees on the edge, why don't they just keep growing into the space if there was a space? You know, what are the environmental conditions that would stop a grass from just growing perpetually?
Mm-hmm. So shade is one thing. If it is a grass that's adapted to sunlight, so an open habitat grass. So a tree, if the growing conditions are good for a tree, it will quickly become so big that there's no more sunlight for the grass, and that will make it hard for that grass to grow. So it needs... What's needed is something that will prevent those seedlings, tree seedlings, from growing into big trees. And that one of that those things is fire, aridity, or seasonal aridity, herbivory can be one thing. And there was something else I was going to say. Temperature could be another thing. So like very cold, frosty winters or something like that. Those are conditions that will prevent those trees from growing. And as long as the growing conditions are fine for the grass, there's enough moisture, it can then grow. So I think most people that work on this think that it's not so much the grass taking over the tree as the sort of dieback of trees giving space to grasses, whether that is climate or some kind of disturbance regime like fire or herbivory.
Yeah, I was trying to think of, you know, did the grass grow from out under the tree, or did the tree leave the grass shaded? But then I guess it doesn't really matter for the grass in and of itself. That's just living wherever it can. It's just, this is between the trees and the climate.
Yeah. Or the fire or something.
Yeah, the fire or other conditions that determine whether or not the trees can be there. The grass is just wherever it can live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the cool thing is that and there's some areas in the tropics where the rainfall is really high, like over 2 meters even, or like between 1500 and 2 meters, or 1500 millimeters and 2000 millimeters. So normally trees would grow there. It would be a forest, but because there's a seasonality and there's fire. And so the fire makes it difficult for those trees to regrow. And so therefore there's savanna instead of forest. So it's one of these things they talk about, alternate states or alternative states. And that is maybe an example of that, where this fire regime is allowing the grasses to form a grassland rather than a forest, even though the climatic conditions would normally be conducive to a forest.
How can you tell if there's a grassland by looking at the fossil record, geological record? Because we know that we don't get, like, most of our rocks are created in wet environments, like you've said before. We don't get upland areas preserved. You don't get, like, a preserved field. So how can you tell if a grassland actually existed or not?
Yeah, so we can look at some of the things that we talked about. So we can look at isotopes, and if we're in an area, a sort of more tropical area, or that was tropical, if we see a strong C4 signal, we feel pretty certain that it was a C4 grassy environment.
That tells you the photosynthesis. It doesn't tell you about the amount of grass.
That's true, but if we it is and it isn't true. So, like, if we see the signal varies. It's like a whole spectrum between 100% C3 to 100% C4, and so if we see 100% C4 signal, an isotopic signal that indicates that, then we feel pretty certain that it's a grassland. It's not a or a savanna, but it's not a closed forest or you know, a mosaic or something. Then people also look at fossil soils, and it turns out that the sort of texture or structure of soils look different if it's under a forest or under a grassland. And so they can look at some of those textures and something called trace fossils of what animals make burrows and roots and things like that. And they can also look at the chemistry of that soil, and they can use that to determine if it was a grassland. So sometimes we can look at that. And then, of course, people look at faunas. So if they see animals that look like something like a grazer today, long legs, tall teeth, big size, and so on, that's consistent with a very open grassy environment. And then phytolith assemblages. So like phytoliths that are preserved in fossil soils that are dominated by phytoliths from open habitat grasses, with very few phytoliths from trees. And maybe those phytoliths are, shapes that are consistent with C4 grasses or something like that. So those are the ways that people look at them. You can also look at pollen. And so I mentioned that grass pollen all more or less look the same, but if you have pollen that come from, say, acacia or some other savanna type tree, then that's a good indicator that this was maybe a savanna, or there are other plants that are adapted to very dry environments. And so you can look at those, like ephedra, for example, Mormon tea and kinopods. So those are the ways that we, and if we can use multiple methods at the same time, all the better.
And I think as well, it might be worth remembering that these proxies, these measures of how to determine if there's a grassland or not, in every discussion that we have about grasslands going forward in this episode, you've got to go back to these proxies. This is where all of this information was gathered, whether it be soil, whether it be the shape and isotopic composition of different animals and carbon isotopes. This is how we build up a picture of everything that we're going to discuss in the rest of this. It's incredibly complicated, and it's really impressive. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, it's great actually, because I think we know so much about grasses, and you know, they're relatively a modern group of plants compared to, you know, ferns or something like that. And so we have a lot of different ways to quiz the fossil record, if you will, by using all these different techniques. And so it's I think unique in terms of the fossil record that we have so many different ways to look at, to sort of interrogate the fossil record about different aspects of grassland ecosystems. So you can get a really rich picture if you have all of these different proxies.
Okay, well, with those proxies in mind, keeping in mind how we get this information, can you say anything about how grasslands were able to spread? Did it, like, I know that you said, like, grasses first appeared in Gondwana, but it was, like, only the last 25 million years or something like that that we got the grasslands. Did it just happen in one place? Did it just, like, a click of the fingers, now we have grasslands everywhere? Did it only happen in, like, coastal environments or at a certain latitude? Where did it happen? How quickly?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, it's important to realize that we have a few windows into this question on different continents, but it is just really a few windows where we have like a continuous record that goes on for several million years so that we can capture all these transitions. So, you know, have to take everything with a grain of salt. But from what we can see, we don't think that it was coeval. And first of all, I should say, we are pretty sure that it happened on many, like all the continents. We don't know about Antarctica, but all the continents at different times and in slightly different ways. One clue to that we had early on is that we see the evolution of herbivores that look like they're eating grasses independently on different continents. And so that tells us that that was the convergence that you talked about. They are all converging on habits that we associate with grasslands today or open habitats. And so we think that these changes happen on all the continents. And the data that we have now based on these multiple lines of evidence indicate that it didn't happen at the same time. It didn't even happen in the same way necessarily. And so, for example, in North America, we have evidence that grasses became ecologically dominant maybe 25 million years ago or so. And that was followed after a few years by animals evolving these, or certain animals like horses evolving really tall teeth that are useful for eating grass, although also useful for eating other abrasive things, and long legs and so on. And so those horses and other animals seem to have been adapting to those new open habitats. Whereas in South America, we found that there were these animals with these tall teeth that evolved some 40 million years ago and onward. But we don't actually see any grassy environments until maybe the last 10 million years. And So those animals were probably adapting to open sort of dusty landscape where they were feeding on very abrasive, just dust and volcanic ash settling on leaves and basically grinding down their teeth. And so these tall teeth were very useful for that as well, even though there were no grasses with abrasive phytoliths in them that they were eating. So we used to think that grasses came first and then came the animals, or sort of roughly at the same time. But now we know that it happened at different times and in a different order even, on different continents. And we see slightly different timing for the evolution of C4 grasslands or spread of C4 grasslands on different continents. And that could relate both to what is ultimately driving that, but also it could relate to yeah, I mean, that's essentially it. With both climate and things like fire and CO2 playing a role, most likely.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what could be driving this? I mean, I guess, like, you can tie it all back to plate tectonics and the ocean currents and how all of that works and what makes one area dry, one area wet. And is there anything that you can point to, anything, any other organisms that evolved around this time? What could be doing it?
Well, so one thing, well, a couple of things. So you mentioned plate tectonics, and it is true that during, you know, at the end of the Cretaceous, and then maybe sort of the one very dramatic thing was the Eocene Oligocene boundary about 34 million years ago, where we get the continents sort of separating and Drake's Passage becoming open between South America and Antarctica, and we get the development of the Circumantarctic Current, which sort of thermally isolated Antarctica and led to the glaciation, permanent glaciation, and so that completely restructured the climatic system of the Earth and how the currents flowed and so on. And that made Earth sort of really slide into a cooler part of its history towards, you know, moving towards the last ice age. And one thing that happened alongside that was that CO2 levels probably went down. They went down during that transition, and then they probably got a little higher about 17 million years ago, and then they have, after 15, they started going down again. And so we have lower CO2 levels, and that is not favorable for trees. So they cannot regrow as quickly in low CO2 levels, whereas grasses are much more efficient at growing and spreading quickly. They're very weedy. And so that could have been something that tipped the scale slightly towards grasses in some climates. And then we got cooler climates overall, more seasonal climates, especially in areas that are inland. So and we also had a lot of mountain building because there was a lot of plate tectonics, a lot of mountains being the Andes, the Rockies, and so on, the Himalayas, the Alps. All of those mountain chains were forming and becoming taller and creating rain shadows to on one side, in North America, on east of the Rockies, for example, you get rain shadow, and that creates drier environments, which could also be favorable for grasses over trees, and increased seasonality both in terms of temperature and rainfall. So we do see the creation of these climatic conditions that we associate with grasslands today during these last 66 million years, the Cenozoic, and especially in the last 34 million years or so. So we do see that, but we don't see, immediately at 34 million years, we don't see an expansion of grasslands. So it can't just be those things, or it has to be something more, or that climates became even more dry, or even more seasonal. And another thing that people are very interested in right now is trying to figure out when fire became a factor. And so that's another fossil record that I didn't mention, the fossil record of charcoal and of different geochemical elements that we associate with fire that people have started looking at, in particular in the last 10, 15 years, and trying to establish a record of when fires became important, because that is usually linked to climate seasonality, rainfall seasonality, but it isn't. We're still figuring out exactly how those two relate in the history of grasslands. But that's another factor. Another factor which is very difficult to assess is herbivory. When there was enough biomass of herbivores to keep landscapes open, basically. That is difficult to measure in the fossil record, and we don't have a good handle on it. But that's another factor that could play in as well, that we see the evolution of these sort of a co-evolution, if you will. I hesitate to say that. But some kind of, you know, when you see big herds of animals that we associate with grasslands, they can also inflict a lot of, you know, damage on vegetation when they come in big herds and they hurts and eat everything, or like elephants that keep landscapes open by eating a lot of branches and trees and stuff like that. But so that's another factor. But the truth is, the truth is that we don't really know. So that's something that is actively being researched and debated. What is sort of the in each individual region, what is the one factor or the set of factors that are really driving these changes in vegetation and ecosystems?
That sounds like it's going to be a lot of work over many, many decades.
Yes.
Yes.
So.
So then if we reflect on the evolution of grasslands in general, what impact have they had at different levels? So from an individual ecosystem to the entire planet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one is the complete restructuring of habitat. So going from close forests with a lot of where animals can live in on different levels in trees and take advantage of fruits and leaves and things like that year round in tropical forests, to a habitat that's very open, that where the main source of plant matter is rather low nutrient grass leaves. And so they have to have a different digestive system and so on, and a different way to feed. So led to a lot of adaptational changes in animals. And also in terms of climate, probably had massive impacts on the distribution of moisture and sort of heat transport and capture, and also impacted the global carbon cycle and the global silica cycle. So some of the things that we talked about. In terms of so I think we sort of talked about this, but these things are very difficult to measure, and so people are still working on trying to figure out, for example, how much would grasslands have affected carbon storage, the distribution, and also like silica cycles and things like that. So it's something that people are actively working on, but we can use modeling to assess it to some degree. And I do think that it's clear that it was very impactful.
I know we've spoken about the herbivores and things like that, but can this evolution of grasslands be tied to any other evolutionary events? Not so much like direct evidence. I don't know if it could be possible to do that, but do people ever say, like when they're talking, I don't know, about fish and nutrient cycling in the seas, someone will just be like, oh yeah, well that's when grasslands evolved, obviously. Or something completely unrelated. Does the evolution of grasslands have like echoes across all kind of like evolutionary events at this time?
It has been hypothesized that the evolution of grasslands impacted the evolution of diatoms, so marine planktonic plankton, mm-hmm. But it hasn't been fully shown. So the impact would be that grasslands retain, they both dissolve a lot of silica from minerals in the soil, but they also retain it in their bodies as phytoliths, and then so it kind of regulates how much silica is transported from land to the water, and that affects in turn how much access diatoms and other silica, other planktonic and or marine organisms that use silica in their bodies, how much, you know, what their silica budget is. So definitely has been speculated that there were diversifications that happened in relation to grasslands, but it all depends on the timing, like really nailing down the timing of these things. In the terrestrial, I mean, people certainly have speculated, or not speculated, they have hypothesized that all, you know, all the large herbivores that we know and love, they evolved their body size and body shape and ways of feeding in response to this major ecological change. But as we talked about, it's not always clear what came first, the quote-unquote grazers or grasses. I'm thinking, so we know so much less about insects, or at least from fossils, but there are, you know, there's a lot of insects adapted to grasslands as well. And I know so much less about microbes, you know, what that whole realm. But I can imagine that there's a unique biota there as well. So yeah, I mean, one thing to say is that there's been some evidence that shrubs and trees that grow in savannas evolved spines and spikes to defend themselves against large herbivores. So that's another thing that's often associated with grasslands, are these sort of spiny plants. But I don't know that that's a major change, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just trying to, because I was just thinking, like, could the evolution of grasslands be have a similar impact as say kind of like a tectonic event? It's like a world changing event, not quite the same scale as a mass extinction or a whole climatic change, but still something so sizable that you can detect it in a lot of different groups. It was just trying to feeling of how big it is.
Well, now that you mention like a detectable, like the way you phrase it, it really makes me think about the Anthropocene, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but this proposed geologic era that is a sort of symbolizes the impact of humans on Earth, and humans is something that has been associated with this change from forests to savannas. It's an extremely hotly debated topic, to what extent humans evolved in open grasslands or savannas or in forests, or what part of their evolution relates to what. But the traditional idea is this thought that humans became bipedal because they had to walk in open landscapes and look around, and that their big brains and their ability to use tools relates to that new way of living. And I think that it's not that simple. It is much more complicated, and I'm sure lots of parts of that story is not correct, but it is a fact that there were savannas and grasslands evolving or spreading in those areas where we think that hominids evolved. And so our species certainly is somewhat of a seismic event in Earth history, because we have changed everything in mostly in a bad way. But yeah, we have impacts everywhere on Earth. So in that regard, if grasslands played a role in the evolution of our own species, then that might maybe is one of the major impacts that grasslands have had.
We can pin the blame on grasses.
No.
I tried.
An unfortunate side effect, perhaps.
Yeah.
No.
So then, speaking of climate change, speaking about the impact of humans and agriculture, grasses are quite popular. I've eaten some today, I've learned. Grasses are going to be all right, but grasslands, are they under threat?
Yeah, I mean, already most of temperate grasslands have been converted to agricultural areas, which is basically eradicating a lot of that diversity that we associate with grasslands. And similarly, savannas are under serious threat, like agriculture, overgrazing, and then climate change. And that is something that will have an effect on all grasses and grasslands. But we don't necessarily know exactly how, because there's, I mean, it's hard to predict exactly how climate is going to change on the ground, like in different regions, and the distribution of precipitation, temperature, and seasonality, and so on. That's, I think, difficult to predict in detail. And then we also have this issue that we know it's going to get warmer. We know CO2 is rising. If CO2 is rising, C3 grasses are favored, but also temperature is rising, which favors C4 grasses. So what is going to win in the end? Which grasses are going to be favored? And this not only has an impact on diversity and you know, animals and these ecosystems, but also on which crops can grow where. And how much. And so there's actually some work being done, trying to see if we can get rice that has C4 photosynthesis as a way to sort of increase our ability to grow things under future climates, which is kind of, it's scary and sad.
It's incredibly significant as well, that we understand this kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And which is one of the reasons, not the initial reason that I am fascinated and interested in grasslands, but it certainly is something that I've become aware of and is really important to me now. Like, I feel that paleontology, providing the history of grasslands, can actually provide clues to how those ecosystems will respond in the future.
One of my questions was going to be, why would grasses be a good subject for a student to study? And I think that alone is a reason for how many people could we get studying this as soon as possible, please?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. There's still so much we don't know. And not just about their history, but sort of how they respond, like their ecological responses and physiological responses. So yes, lots to do.
And in terms of the evolution of grasses and of grasslands, what are still some of the questions left unknown about that?
Oh, so much. So as I mentioned, like, there's so little known about the early history of grasses, when, where they evolved, how they spread among continents, what their ecological role was. And that's maybe less important for sort of future applications, if you will, but still extremely fascinating to understand how a group that is so evolutionarily successful, if you will, given how important they are today, why it took so long for them to sort of become so important, and what was holding them back, and is that a common evolutionary pattern that we see? There's some indications that it might be. And then just understanding the global patterns and timing of different parts of sort of ecosystem assembly within the grasslands, C3, C4 grasslands, the faunas, and so on, understanding that so that we can then better test what might have been drivers. So we have examples on many different continents, even though, like I said, the windows are quite small and limited. And there, the more we know, the more complicated the story is. So we really need to understand that better. And that will hopefully help us test what are the drivers and what are really the things that can change grasslands. And one thing I forgot to mention is that we think that grasslands, it's not just the grasses, it's also the other plants and animals that they have co-evolved with that controls how they will respond to different climate changes, different CO2 changes, different changes in fire and so on. That is all like a product of their history that's interwoven among these different organisms that occupy grasslands. So it is a really complex problem to understand, but it is super worthwhile given how important grasses and grasslands are. That was a very long-winded answer to your question. I'm sorry.
It made absolute sense, and I can see why it's so important. So, yeah, that's it. But I guess a bonus question just from me is, are you excited about plant research in general at the minute? Like, does it keep delivering big surprises? Do you wake up every day, go into log on to your computer and find that some big discovery has been made and you've now got to change how you think about X and Y? Is it all super stable and boring and nerdy, or is it never know what you're going to get?
No, it's the former. It's new. As I feel like it's just accelerating, and people are like not just studying, coming up with new fossil records, but also coming up with new ways to probe the fossil record, or so like new proxies, if you will, and it's just multiplying. It's so amazing and fascinating. And then not just ways to look at the fossil record, but new ways to analyze phylogenies and new ways to look at physiology and ecology of plants. Yeah, it is constantly evolving and super, super fascinating and exciting. Yes.
We should start a grass podcast.
Yes.
There'd be enough content.
It would be, yes.
Episodes every week.
Every week. Something new.
Caroline, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
My absolute pleasure. It was very fun.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content. And thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.